Welcome to Film Corner. But who's this? Emerging from the depth of the corner, it's a new corner.
It's a new corner Easter. It's a new corner Easter.
Corner Easter.
It's a new corner Easter.
Covered in fluff and bits of lint.
Was he here all along? Deeper in the corner. He was deep in the dark recesses of the corner, wasn't he?
He was more film corner than either of us.
He's more film corner. He's deep corner.
I was waiting for the right movie, you see.
Yeah.
Has to be a tentpole cultural event to get me out of that corner.
Yeah. And a bit like a gigantic, revolting, eyeless, sort of...
Space worm.
Megatooth space worm. You've come up right underneath us.
A creature that has evolved just to be its own digestive tract and nothing else.
it's taken everything else out of the system.
Everything else.
It's boiled it down
superfluous.
To the perfect. Yeah. It's pure digestive tract, isn't it?
Eyes. No. Ears. No. Liver. No. Lungs. No. Heart.
Wings.
No.
What do those worms do for fun? Do they have a sense of fun?
Well, it seems so. The small ones don't. We did learn that the small ones don't get on very well together.
We never met adolescents, though, did we? We've met babies and full grown.
But I don't think we can judge the whole species based on the fact that the babies misbehave and kill each other.
But what's the teenage scene like? What's it like dating on Arrakis?
Anyway, I feel like we've skipped forward.
Well, yeah, have we skipped forward? We have skipped.
We haven't told them what film we're talking about yet. And we didn't guess.
We're talking about, of course, The Remains of the Day, starring Sir Anthony Hopkins.
The lesser noticed subtext.
Yeah, which is, it's basically about a giant worm, isn't it? It's pretty. Oh, now, by the way, before we get into the meat of the topic, maybe we could have a little chat about what we're drinking.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And see, does it reflect who we are as people?
Or does it reflect today's movie?
Interesting.
Does it reflect who we are as people, or does it reflect our mythos?
Exactly.
That's the question.
There is a beer called Mythos. Is that what you're drinking, Mike?
It isn't, actually.
What are you drinking, Mike?
But I have clutched a can of powder keg Pilsner, which is brewed just a few miles away from where I live.
Oh, so it's a nice local?
It's a local Devonshire.
Let's have a look.
Hold her up.
It's very nice as well. It's very tasty.
It's sort of keep it local.
Keep it local.
None of this. So it's quite
it's very much a protectionist beer.
It's quite. It feels quite protectionist. It feels quite. It's quite Brexit, isn't it? It's quite.
We now have the freedom to brew beer on a small scale.
Yeah.
Package them in premium cans.
It's quite. We import how much cheese, darling? Come here. Come in here and listen to this, darling. Turn the telly up.
I tell you what, though, this would shatter the Brexit dream, because I think the average gammon would be very upset to see that this Pilsner is both gluten-free and vegan.
Oh, God, no, that's anti-Brexit.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was that fizzy woke juice?
It does say on it, free-thinking beer, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which is quite GB news.
Mm. By the way, just a quick reminder, Film Corner is Brexit neutral. Isn't it?
Absolutely.
So, because the concept of a corner, isn't it? It's three things coming together. That's what a corner is. Three lines intersecting.
Yeah.
We adopt...
It's very much a 3D corner, is it?
It's a 3D corner.
Were you 2D corner before?
It was 2D corner. We still called it 3D corner. We called it Film Corner, didn't we, before?
But it could have been a 2D corner.
And we had a picture of... That's true. That's true. Maybe it was a 2D corner. Now we can represent all three takes on Brexit, don't we? Pro, anti, and...
Fervor.
Yeah. Fervor. Just general fervor. Anyway, Ben, what are you drinking?
So I'm drinking a beer called Pilsner Urquell.
Oh. I thought it was Disney. I thought you were drinking, I read Disney.
Disney Brew. And the reason I drink this quite a lot, is because once, about 4 years ago, I read a pamphlet somewhere that said that Pilsner Urquell is how lager's meant to taste.
so you just been completely sold on a piece of marketing?
No, because it's sold on a piece of absolute bullshit.
Normally, it's Henry that gets suckered by this.
That's normally my. That's what happens to me.
So that wasn't written by Pilsner Urquell. That was written by some sort of boring, you know, beer bastard.
Mm-hmm.
And the words used were biscuity,
mm-hmm.
and then something to do with the quality of the water in that part of the world.
Okay,
Is it nice?
It's lager, isn't it?
I mean, is it a pilsner essentially? Does it have the quality of a pilsner that you'd associate with a pilsner? Or
so what qualities would you associate with the pilsner?
He's got the pilsner. Have the level of hop intensity and probably the barley fizz will have because the amount of time it spends in the tanks.
The yeast ratio.
The east west ratio. Well,
yeast is what I say, but yeah, by all means, dig yourself into a geographical hole.
No, but is it is it hop? Would you say it's hoppy or is it more of a tart? Is it how much tannin is there? Does it have good legs? Does it stick to the roof?
Whose nose has it got?
Yeah, does it?
It's got a lovely after burp.
Oh, that's nice.
So what are you drinking, Henry?
Can I say what would be the beer that would most represent who I am in this
as a member of the metropolitan elite?
Exactly.
I wonder if he's got like a Camden Pale Ale or something.
Some sort of microbrewery IPA.
If only I was as
or neck oil kind of thing.
Unlike Ben, I'm not someone that falls for cheap marketing fads.
Mm-hmm.
I
G&T in a can.
Oh no.
Oh.
It's a lovely little continental beer.
Bottle of Corona.
What's great about the Corona is that it has a lovely little modern twist, which is, look in that neck.
Yeah.
Look in my neck. There's a little segment of lime in it.
Yeah.
So continental, so new, so 2024.
See, we couldn't dare to dream of even having a lime available to slice up.
Wouldn't know what the...
I mean, if we had a lime in the house, I wouldn't be doing this. I'd be inviting everyone round to have a look at it.
I have found some kind of cursed orange.
Which exercise it.
Yeah.
Put it on the pyre.
Name it.
March it through town. Hang it, draw it, quarter it.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah.
I kind of say, I think Corona is absolute horse piss.
No, I'm not going to argue with that. But I quite like it. I like the lime element also. But one thing you know that's annoying about Coronas, they're an absolute recycling headache.
Why?
Because is it in the glass recycling or is it in the organic recycling? It's got both bits in it.
Because of the lime inside it?
Because of the lime inside it.
I don't even want to be lugging a glass bottle in the food waste bin, mate.
Well, maybe I've picked the wrong side these
days. Between the two.
I suppose you'd lean on the side of glass, wouldn't you?
You'd lean on the side of fishing your lime out.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've never thought, maybe not as much of a dilemma as I thought. Anyway, film corner. We're not here to talk about what beers we all drink, so I probably shouldn't have brought it up.
No.
We're here because you have been cornered by three men who want to talk at you about a film.
Now, we should say, I think this stands to reason. Is that the right phrase?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it depends what you're going to say next.
This will be spoiler heavy. So if that's an issue for you and you want to not know what happens in June 1 or June 2,
yeah,
please leave now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an
easily escaped corner. We're in the corner. You're not backed into the corner.
No, you're on the other side of the corner.
Yeah.
Yeah, at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. But wait till we lock you in with our charm and irreverent wit.
Now, I can't remember how we did this last time. We sort of broke it down into portions.
I don't know if we should do that, you know. I wonder if we should be more free-form this time.
Okay.
Did you like the formatting element?
I think it kept us on our toes a bit.
Did it? Okay, yeah, maybe we should.
I'm a bit worried that this one, because both films... So we're going to have to slightly pre-see June 1, right, for people who aren't going to watch either film.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, okay, yeah, good chat. Just give... Well, actually, Ben, you've watched June 1 very recently, so to catch up, haven't you? Because you hadn't, you were completely ignorant of the universe of Arrakis, weren't you, like 3 days ago?
Yeah. I was quite annoyed, actually, can I say?
That we chose June 2, because you had to watch June 1.
You gave me a seven-hour bit of homework, essentially.
Yeah, we gave you a huge... We gave you the equivalent of Edward Gibbon's the Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire as a birthday present. Give me a break.
Yeah, so I had to watch June 1 to catch up. I was considering just seeing June 2, but I'm glad I didn't because it just picks up. It's like a TV show. It just stops and then starts again. There's no sense that you could watch the second one on its own.
No.
No, that's true.
You have no idea what
Empire Strikes Back, it ain't.
And the first one just stopped at the end, and I felt quite annoyed. And it was only because I knew I was going to see Dune 2 the next day that I wasn't truly annoyed.
Okay.
So it's worked out quite well.
Yeah.
Although the stakes were quite high for you, because if you hated the universe of Dune, you were going to be in all kinds of
how do you know I didn't hate the universe
of Dune?
Which
you may have done.
Well, good point. We don't know. We've got no idea yet what we thought of it.
We're dealing with the nation's premium naysayer here.
Because that's true. That's true.
So shall I pray see Dune 1?
Yeah, go on.
Okay.
Yeah, go on.
I hope you're sitting comfortably. Here comes...
2.5 hour. Frame by frame summary of the film Dune 1.
Dune 1. There are some things I didn't really fully understand what's happening anyway. And for the first hour or so, I was quite bored and I was dual screening.
Mm-hmm. What, you were dual screening?
Yeah.
What were you watching at the same time?
Dune I was 2. Just mindlessly scrolling through Instagram.
Ben, come on, man.
So the first hour seemed very exposition heavy, right? Because there's a lot to learn about the planets and what everything's going on. And they do the classic film thing of making one of the characters have to learn that as well. So he's having lessons about the planet they're going to.
Yeah.
So he's listening to an audiobook, essentially.
That's going, right, a futuristic
the planet
audiobook.
Of Arrakis has covered in
That's
space.
That's true, because, yeah.
Which I always think is a bit of a cheat in a film, but I can't think of a better way they could have got around it. But there was a lot of explaining the atmospheric situation in certain planets and... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a worm in the podcast. It looks like there's a big faceless worm. Just I mean, in our midst, right?
I don't know what the easiest way is around that.
Put grappling hooks in Ben's back and ride him around.
Are you into fantasy generally, though?
But hang on, chaps.
Yeah.
I'm not naysaying this film. Mm. I enjoyed it. And I put down my phone as soon as the first worm appeared.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Your brethren, your kinfolk.
But you have to wait a long time. You've got to wait like an hour of just nonsense. And then they get there, and then the worm happens, and you're like, I'm in. Let's worm.
Yeah. Yeah, the worms are good.
So,
okay.
Basic storyline is family, they're sent to a planet where they have to mine a mineral type thing called spice.
They're a ducal family, aren't they? They're a sort of high, it's very much an elite, sort of aristocratic.
Yeah,
slightly Scottish tinged. There's an interesting mixture, isn't there, of futuristic and old-fashioned costume. And
what Henry is saying is they're all in space, but sometimes someone plays the bagpipes.
Sometimes someone break out the bagpipes.
And I think they didn't bother doing that in the second one. They sort of left the Scottish thing behind a bit, which is
they
weird.
Left that behind.
Bit weird.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yes, they're like a big family.
And the Emperor, the sort of top dog in the universe.
Yeah.
Extraordinarily played by Christopher Walken.
That's right. But we don't know it's Christopher Walken at that point in the first
Insane casting, by the way.
Yeah, insane casting. Has sent them to the planet of Arrakis.
To mine or kind of collect this substance called spice, which is a mineral type thing.
I think it's pivotal to space navigation or something, isn't it? Is the idea. It's the most valuable thing there is in the...
It's often seen as being a metaphor for oil.
Oh yeah, it's quite a clunking metaphor for oil.
It's a fairly clunking metaphor for oil.
Henry introduced that as if he had a very sort of high reading of this thing, you know. Like,
well, I see. I wasn't sure if you guys would have been up on that, but I presumably you've done some googling. Yeah, I didn't need to google it. I worked that by myself.
And they get to the planet. There's some people there who already live there who are kind of like the colonized people, I guess.
Yeah, the Fremen.
The Fremen.
Yeah.
Mm. Fremen is one of those words that it's too close to frenulum for my liking.
What does frenulum mean again?
I think
actually, it's... not again. What does it mean?
I mean, Mike has more of an anatomical background than us two. Doesn't it sort of connect the skin of your knob to the end of your knob?
Yeah, it's a bit of your dick. Exactly, yeah. Stringy bit of your dick.
Oh, God. That feels like that's a shame, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I think sometimes when you've got a whole universe to build, right, you've got so much vocab to put in, so much glossary, sometimes there's just going to be a word that just goes, there's something about that. Yeah, I like that. That feels like a real word. But he's just, someone's been talking about frenulum to his voice.
He may have just seen his GP.
Yes, just seen
before he wrote that bit.
Yeah.
Who's been reconstructing his frenulum.
Yeah.
Reconstructing his frenulum. Because Because of his insistence on always trying to make his penis look like a space worm. By drawing on it with felt tips. By the way, in terms of futuristic naming, I think generally across the franchise, the two films, I do actually think the futuristic naming is very good in these films.
Arrakis.
And in the Dune universe.
But I had a point about this, which was everyone's got a name, like a good futuristic name. Apart from the main character, who's called Paul.
Paul, come on.
Agreed. He really dropped... he dropped the ball on Paul, didn't he? He dropped the Paul ball. Yeah, you're right. Paul. Not Paulisto.
No.
Paraco.
Even if he'd just taken one of the letters out of Paul,
Paul.
It would have been okay, yeah.
Paul. All right, Paul.
Hey. Yeah.
Yeah, it would go with the piping, wouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so Paul struck me as weird. And like... Maybe in Dune 3 he'll meet someone called Terry, or, you know, to make it more normal that he's got like a normal name.
Yeah, he's the only normal name. But it's a bit like Luke Skywalker. Is that Luke Skywalker? Luke. Luke is called Luke.
Yeah, and everyone else is called Obi-Wan.
Obi-Wan, interesting.
More about the links with Star Wars later, I would imagine, because it's quite bizarre.
A lot of links with Star Wars, yeah.
There's a bit of that.
So they are mining this stuff, and then it was all a trap, somehow.
Yeah, because they've been sent to that planet to replace the previous family that was running things on Arrakis, which was a family of absolute. I think we can say like what knobs, gits, dickheads.
Yeah, the galactic level,
galactic bastards.
Are they the bald guys?
It's the bald guys.
It's twatmageddon.
Absolutely,
it paints bald people in a very poor light. Indeed,
it really does. Well. Well, I think again that both films. Well, I've got things to say about the baldness. The thing is, what's happening? Is we're just talking about the first film, aren't we? Should we let you do the summary?
We'll get to the end. Yeah, we'll get to it quickly
because I want to. I think the film is problematic around baldness. I'm not going to.
And it turns out it was all a trap, and then the bald people send a big army, and try to kill off all of the people from the family who were sent there. They manage to do that. They kill everyone apart from Paul and Paul's mum. Can't remember
who's
her name.
Who's a witch. Who's a sort of space witch.
Jan. Brenda.
Jan, we can call her Jan.
I think it's Jan. But she is a member of the something, the Jezzerat or something. Was it
the Jedi?
Bene something?
Essentially quite Jedi-ish. The Bene Jezzerat, or sort of Jezzerat, which who are like quite... basically quite sort of hot space witches. Can I say that?
About Charlotte Rampling?
Oh, you've got a problem with that, have you? Well, I mean, they're just, I think just the concept of them.
Of a holy mother.
You find that arousing, do you?
I just find it...
A sorority of ultra-powerful...
I find them absolutely
people
intriguing.
Who've got sort of Jedi mind tricks and things.
Yeah. And the way that the thing they do with their voice...
Yes, they've got a trick where they can go... They can say something in a very stern words, and it makes people do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, as long as it sounds as if they've just woken up after a massive bender, basically. That's the trick.
That's what happens, isn't it?
Yeah. Give me the knife.
Yeah. It's brilliant. That's good.
As soon as they've cleared their throat, it's gone.
But then you just give them the knife.
Yeah.
And then the film ends where basically Paul, who's the son of the sort of main duke of the family... his mother remains, she's pregnant. They go into the desert where the sort of indigenous desert folk,
the Fremen,
one of them challenges him to a fight. He wins in the fight, which means they kind of accept him,
they respect him,
and that's the end of the film.
And his dad has been murdered, all his whole family has been,
but he has met Javier Bardem and Zendaya.
Can I say, I didn't know it was Javier Bardem until the credits of the second film.
I didn't know it was Javier Bardem until Mike just said Javier Bardem.
Javier Bardem. This is fresh, hot news to Film Corner.
Oh, wow. I felt I knew it was Javier Bardem as soon as it was Javier Bardem.
But that's the unique thing we bring with Film Corner is we're not film experts.
Some of us are quite familiar with Javier Bardem, others less so.
Now, you see, I thought it was... I watched the film thinking... The second one, which he's much more prominent in,
yeah,
thinking it was a Javier Bardem type, That's what I thought throughout. I thought, this guy's a bit like Javier Bardem. So weirdly, I was thinking about Javier
Bardem.
This is
a Spanish
throughout.
Bloke in his 50s.
Spanish bloke in his 50s he's in a really, really big film.
Yeah.
And he's reminding the hell out of him. He's just...
He's going to give Javier Bardem a run for his money. Javier Bardem is about this guy. Javier's going to be worried.
Who the hell is this guy? Because
can I say, Henry, that there's a very similar actor in the film who's in the second one quite a lot, who's the guy who like teaches Paul to fight. Okay.
I love that guy.
Yeah. Is he...
Josh Brolin?
He's Josh Brolin.
Okay. I was thinking just Jeff Bridges type.
He's absolutely. I love Josh Brolin. He is. He's Jeff Bridges. To me, he is. If you took Jesse Plemons,
yeah,
and mingled him with
the gravitas of Plemons,
the gravitas of Plemons,
the ruggedness of Bridges,
the ruggedness of Bridges, but also the delicate, almost feline beauty of Carol Vorderman. Do you know what I mean? I absolutely love him. He's bloody good, and he's. For some reason, I'm drawn. I mean, maybe I don't know if we all are, but it's obviously got a lot of these mythic character types in it. It's that high sort of high register mythic storytelling.
Yeah,
and he's the assistant, the kind of the kind of rugged, family sort of faithful guy who served the family.
I was a friend of your father.
Exactly.
He's the older, seasoned pro in a lower rank. Guy.
Yes, exactly.
The master
lower
sergeant
rank,
at arms.
Seasoned as absolute hell.
But he takes orders.
He takes orders. And he would do anything for you. He would, he would happily, offers to sacrifice his life for you.
Yeah.
As the firstborn of that family on a daily basis.
He might be another name. I mean, he is called Gurney, which feels odd.
Yeah, that's a bit of a weird one.
And can I just say in a wider sense, increasingly now, when I watch a film, any American film, there's normally a guy in it where I'm like, could be Jeff Bridges.
Jeff Bridges time.
But I'm not sure. Yeah.
Okay. And that was him for you?
That was him for me. But in every film, there'll be one.
Well, Bridges is that guy. And he's the guy that, personally, I'm really drawn to. And I really, he's my top list of I don't want him to die. So I was so pleased. Spoiler alert. I mean, obviously spoilers. When he turns out to have survived.
Yeah.
Because we meet him in the second film. I think we sort of semi-assumed he's been killed with all the rest of them.
Yeah.
But he's hanging out with a bunch of like...
sort of mercenary types?
It's another sort of strugglers. It's another trope from the Star Wars world and from all these kinds of stories of... Because you've got a very rigid, hierarchical, sort of feudal or something system of houses and sort of serf types who work for them. And like, but then you've got outside... There's a little outside the system crew we suddenly meet and suddenly realize it's possible that you can be like freelance spice collectors. Is that what they are? They're sort of self-employed.
Yeah, they're kind of smugglers, I think. Are they? They're not meant to be doing it, certainly.
No. When we meet him, he's playing a guitar.
Yes.
He briefly sings a few lines from a song. I'd love to sort of go back and hear that again. It was quite good, I think.
But it's a space guitar, so it's got one or two extra strings.
It was a space guitar. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
But have you...
Because guitars have evolved.
Even guitars have evolved a bit.
Mm. So what's the best way to tackle this? It's a big film.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, are we supposed to... I mean, I think we should tell them the story. Are we supposed to tell about the story and stuff when you talk about a film?
Well, we can't take it for granted that anyone's watched it, so we have to give them some context.
Well, should we do another quick... Maybe this time we can do a summary of the film again. But we can this time we can stop off more as we go through it to talk about themes that come up and stuff. I'd like to start talking about Dune 2 by talking about where I watched it.
Cool. Okay.
Which was the darling, darling Barbican.
Oh, my word.
I watched it in the Barbican. Now,
and was it a dance interpretation of it?
Of course. I didn't watch any films that aren't through the medium of dance interpretation.
My projector is Matthew Bourne.
I will only watch a film if everyone in it is a swan, is played as a swan, and how a swan would react if a swan was a giant whale, for example. A desert swan. Now, I watched it in the Barbican, which is a bit like... the Barbican is a bit like the world of Dune, in a way. It's quite a futuristic...
Yeah, concretey.
It's a concretey, futuristic, but also feels a bit old-fashioned. Mm. Mm-hmm. It's a place where I imagine Mike, if you if you've ever been to the pub, can you just assume you were hallucinating or something? You wouldn't. Have you ever been there?
I have been there a number of times. I've even been there quite recently.
How did you feel about it?
Well, I just thought it was all it's a waste of a perfectly good car park.
you thought you were watching a symphony or something being played.
A smashing Japanese import. Most recently, I was there to see My Neighbour Totoro.
Did you see that?
I did see that.
It's good. What's that? What's it like?
It's bloody brilliant.
I really want to see it, but it's sold out.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. Design-wise, in particular, it's a mind-boggler.
No, but basically, the Barbican is. You know, there are some films where you have to watch them in the cinema. People say that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also, there are some films for me where I think you have to watch them in the Barbican.
Mike, where did you watch the film?
I watched it. I was in London, so I was between things. So I ducked into a View Piccadilly because they had a screening that was the perfect time.
Okay.
I always find that to be one of the most soulless places to watch a film.
Yeah,
I mean, there were certainly nothing like the Barbican.
Six of us in there.
Yeah.
There was only one. Pair of people who were there as, like, you know, everyone else was flying solo. You know.
Okay. And did you feel that Tom Stoppard may have graced those halls? Probably
didn't
not.
Feel very Stoppardy. Yeah. Particularly. No.
Because Stoppard has sat on every seat in the Barbican.
It just felt like a space that had been drained of something, that something awful had happened there. It had been drained and cleaned out, and someone thought probably could have put cinema in there.
Yeah, it does have that feel.
It's a job.
It's quite subterranean, isn't it? Is that the one that's quite undergroundy?
Yeah.
Quite bleak.
Quite bleak.
Ben?
But you can hear the Bakerloo line. It sounds just like one of the Desert Worms, right? So
rumbling.
It's immersive.
Yeah. Which, of course, some people say the worms are a metaphor for the Bakerloo line, don't they? That's one of the theories. Ben, where did you watch it?
I watched it in my local multiplex. There was five of us in there, all of us solo middle-aged men.
Right.
And I have to say that we looked like that bald race of evil people from the film.
Right. Yeah.
One guy especially looked a lot like the really bad, the baddie bad one.
God, he's a horrible guy.
You look bad enough that if someone sliced you up with a space sword, anyone watching really wouldn't be too worried about it at all.
No.
Yeah, they're not thinking about the kids you left behind.
And I had to move seats because just as the film opened, the guy behind me let off like an atomic fart. Like,
oh, come on, man.
Yeah.
Come on.
So you also, like, all of you, if you had been run through with a Chris knife and were then sort of drained for water, which is what the Fremen do with all their corpses, they'd look at the liquid coming out and go, we can't use this.
Not even for the machinery.
They'll do more harm than good, honestly.
Maybe we could possibly clean the bog, but even then we might damage the bog.
We might damage the bog. Honestly, just leave it. honestly, just leave it, Barnaby. Let's go. So the future.
Mm.
It takes up where the last film left off. So they're in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
Paul and his mum, Jan.
Yeah.
They're in the desert sort of hanging out with their new Fremen friends, played, who's led by Javier Bardem. By the way, in my viewing, which is the Barbican, was actually a very cosmopolitan mixture of attractive people of a range of ages and backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Lots of polyglots.
so many polyglots.
Lots of amateur painters.
People were whooping in different accents and languages, and some people were changing accent and language throughout, you know, themselves.
And their farts smelled like sweet cinnamon and cloves.
So many sweet cloves. Look, Christmas, quite Christmassy nutmeggy farts. Really nice, actually.
Quite rich.
But in my viewing, there's actually quite a lot of young people, and they were loving Javier Bardem's comedy. They were finding him hilarious and laughing. Did that happen in your...
No one laughed at all.
I didn't notice any comedy.
No, exactly. No. It was Javier Bardem was giving it, who I assumed was a Javier Bardem type, like an exact doppelganger of Javier Bardem,
and voicelganger as well.
and a profoundly accurate voice Allganger. And just a stage presence Allganger, actually. a screen presence Allganger.
And filmography ganger.
And a filmography ganger. And it turned out an actual person ganger at the end, and after his name come up in the credits.
He's a uni ganger.
He was played by his own uni ganger in the film. But they were finding a lot of comedy in his... Because there is a kind of slightly light... I don't know if you noticed this. There is a slightly Life of Brian-y comedy going on.
Oh, it is. It's Life of Brian meets Star Wars. Basically.
I think it is supposed to be... I think he is supposed to be funny.
A comic relief character. Yeah, I thought his comedy was quite good. Because he basically, whatever Paul does... So some people think Paul is the Messiah, in inverted commas. I think it's the Don Burrito.
He's the Don Burrito.
I think because the Don Burrito,
the chosen one,
they call it, and so whatever he does, Javier Bardem always goes, "I told you, you see, he is the."
It is written
as it was written.
As it was written, and it's quite funny.
Actually, now I realise that was meant to be funny, but
yes, it was meant to be funny.
I did not. I mean, my one criticism of the first film, especially, is that it's very po-faced.
The first film. I mean, they're both quite po-faced.
I mean, but the second one is so po-faced to the point where it took me a while to work out that the Javier Bardem stuff was supposed to be a bit of comic relief, because I just assumed...
We were meant to sort of take it on face value.
It's just another... Yeah, we're going into a bit of religious fervour here. It's maybe in the third or fourth time he did it, I was like, oh, I see.
This is supposed to be a bit of lightness.
Yeah.
But again, there's these kinds of film... The other thing, by the way, the other film this reminds me of a bit is it's definitely got some Avatar in it.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
it's like dry
hammer hair lady got a lot of work.
Hammer hair. But you know what it is? It's like there's a lot of hammer hair.
Yeah.
But it's hey,
it's agony slightly, hammer hair. Hammer hair in Avatar is sort of like we're a joyful, you know, we are among the wealth of nature. Yeah. We don't need you. Here it's the agonized hey. It's the sort of stubbed toe, the hammer hair of the oppressed.
I tell you what, the soundtrack would be quite a tough listen because it's good for storytelling, but it's a lot of like just sort of screams and like metal crunching sounds and stuff. Like, there's a lot of, isn't there, in the soundtrack? And
speaking of which, of that sound, I think genuinely my favourite bit of both films is the first 3 seconds where some froggy bloke comes on and goes, and he says something quite cool. And then he's off. I don't want to see more. Who's this guy? I want to hear about this guy.
I think I missed that both times. First time I was double screening, second time the guy just farted and I was moving.
It's literally just a sentence. Someone says something really sage, but in a really weird space languagey voice.
You don't see his face, though, do you? It's on a black screen.
No, you don't see. You never see.
And it happens before the Warner, the 20th Century Fox bit. Yeah. So it really hits you out of the blue. It goes, and then it's subtitles. Yeah. It goes something like, spice is good. You must buy spice. Get some spice. I got good spice deals.
Two for one on spice.
2 for 1 on spice.
Why not get some from the foyer?
2 for 1 on Chinese five spice, which in a way means 10 for 5. Depends how you...
I wanted to see that guy, but you never see
him. Well, maybe in the third one we'll finally see him.
Literally his voice is... but more metallic.
Yeah.
So it starts with them in the desert. Some of these really horrible bald guys get dropped down, and there's a big fight. It's quite good. I like the beginning.
Well, he has to do his Lawrence of Arabia bit, doesn't he? Number two. He has to learn the ways of the desert and go from being an outsider to being a guerrilla leader, military leader.
Which obviously has echoes of Avatar learning the ways of Avatar is like wet June, isn't it? Basically,
he's got to go native. Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, this is dry Avatar.
Which way you want to spice it. But it's slightly classier. It's a classier Avatar.
Oh, it's much.
It?
Let's get this out of the way. It's much better than Avatar.
It's much better.
Oh yeah.
Because Avatar is the worst film ever made.
Yeah. I think we can say that now looking back, can't we? Yeah. It was the worst film ever made.
Ludicrous.
Yeah, by miles.
With that sound thing and that sound voice, it does do a thing that I find quite annoying that happens in these kind of films, is where they give the baddie a voice where it sounds like it's gone through some kind of effects pedal.
Yeah.
But it does just sound like that. So it doesn't really sound like it's coming out of their mouth. And they just kind of go, bring me him! And it'll kind of have
bring
this kind of...
Bring me him.
Yeah, it's kind of got stuff going on.
When they do the voice, when like the Reverend Mothers do the...
I like the Reverend Mothers voice.
Or general baddies.
No, that's okay. That voice thing's fine. It's more like the big, bald, fat...
The Baron.
Guy.
He's great. Can we give him some respect? I like him.
Stellan Skarsgård
plays the Baron.
They did that much better than the Lynch original, that character is just too gross. Right, it's just pus sort of, riddled. Foul.
He's more like one of the people that Ben was watching the film with.
Yeah.
It's just too much.
I mean, it's the other way around. I mean, that's a lot of people watching Dune 2, watching the Baron with his live support equipment floating about, will think first, as I did, of Benjamin and the Bean Machine. Of course,
that's true. It is very similar to Benjamin.
Completely intertwined.
Yeah, because he's attached by pipes and stuff to the kind of weird...
Yeah, without which he cannot survive for long.
Yeah, is that since he was poisoned in the first one? Is that keeping him alive?
No, he definitely had some stuff going on in the first one. I don't know if it was exactly the same stuff.
I think it got worse in the second one because he'd been poisoned, so they had to put more pipes in. I think basically
more pipes is it? Okay, yeah. He definitely had some kit. He's definitely had his weird oily baths. He does love a spa dunk, doesn't he? Big oily.
You know, it reminds me of when you get balsamic vinegar and olive oil
exactly,
in a restaurant.
That's exactly. I was just thinking that. And you dip a huge fat bald man in it. So
he represents sourdough, are we saying?
Yeah, he is sourdough.
Mm.
You're right, because it's definitely got two liquids in it, an oil and something else that isn't, it's an emulsion, isn't it?
Yeah.
And sometimes you get these big globules of oil floating about in it.
Yeah, so just to explain, the baddie is this large, corpulent, bald guy who can float.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But who lives under oil, basically, most of the time.
Yeah, so he emerges from a big black sort of tar pit, like a sort of jacuzzi full of, or black syrup. You know, golden syrup has that black version.
He's got very poorly controlled psoriasis, basically, is what's happening. Yeah.
Very poorly controlled psoriasis?
Yeah.
Is that what it is? It's keeping his skin sort of on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
Well, maybe we can talk about the baddies now properly. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So they are called the Harkonnen.
Yeah.
And they are I think what they represent is a take on what the author and filmmakers think society would be like if it was run by bald people.
Here we go.
So the author believes clearly that bald people feel that life is, I mean, couldn't be cheaper. Right?
Yeah.
They have absolutely no regard.
Yeah.
For life, the sanctity of life.
They'll willy-nilly doesn't cover it. It doesn't cover the way they kill people, does it? It's more casual than willy-nilly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Members of their own entourage, people who've just done their nails, whoever it is.
And just to sort of make a point, just anyone can have their throat slashed at any moment.
Yeah.
Even more so, which again is a bit Star Warsy, because you know the way on the Death Star, people are always, Darth Vader's always just, if people piss him off, people are getting it in the neck the whole time. It's like that sort of vibe, isn't it?
It's a classic supervillain trope.
Yeah. As soon as you annoy anyone, they kill you.
But they go to town with it. I mean, most movies, they'll give them one or two. But, I mean, these guys are relentless.
Yeah.
I mean, they get through them, don't they?
They really do. And
they've got kind of like a phalanx of concubines that they kill at will as well.
Yeah, they kill the concubines. Again, it's bald. I mean, there's an argument. I mean, we'll never know. It's a thought experiment. What society would be like if it was controlled by bald people? But they're implying that there'd be a sort of. I think there seems to be some cannibalism going on.
Yes, there is. Yeah,
he's got these kind of three bald, like, wenches, hasn't he? The baddie who is sort of coo every time he stabs and kills someone. They sort of get very excited. I think there's a reference to them eating them and stuff.
Yes, that's true.
So it's a society completely devoid of pity. Violence is everything for them.
There's a good. Violence, I like the scene where they did the gladiator thing.
Yeah, they have a gladiator. Yeah.
Devoid of decor as well, I would say. Very few sort of framed photographs or.
Well, it's a universe that's low on knickknacks.
You're not seeing any nephews' pictures on the fridge or anything like that in the Harkonnen world. None of that's going on.
There's not a lot of
no books. No books. No bookshelves.
There's
books
not a lot of books. There's not a lot of ornaments.
Mm-hmm.
There's not, I don't believe there's a single fridge magnet in either film, which suggests they didn't go on holiday. there's not a lot of clutter, is there? It's a very clutter-free universe.
It's decluttered fully.
Another thing I noticed, by the way, which is what it has, something it has in common with Star Wars, is total lack of luggage.
Yeah.
So it's another luggage-free film.
Mm-hmm. True of almost every movie, but we'll
see.
Apart from Titanic, where we see him loaded onto the ship.
Yeah, right. And Indiana Jones and the Samsonite Range of Terror. Yeah. Also, something I noticed: there's no journalism.
Oh, God. It's true. You don't see any war correspondents, do you?
There's absolutely no sense of anyone reading the news.
No one's interviewing a Harkonnen for a sort of nice puff piece or Hello magazine.
Yeah. There's no... There's no one...
photos of him slicing the throats of his concubines in his...
Are you telling me they wouldn't...
favourite slaughter room.
Are you telling me John Simpson wouldn't be out there? He'd be out there. He'd be deeply embedded with the Harkonnen. Or that bloke who's always in Russia. What's he called, that correspondent? Joshua Rosenberg.
Steven Seagal. He's the kind of person that Steven Seagal would befriend, basically.
Yeah, yeah, he'd be there.
Dennis Rodman.
Yeah. But that's what happens with these like...
I know what you mean. What it is it feels like... They feel weird because it feels like a kind of race of people or whatever, or a culture that has no culture, basically. There's no culture.
Mm. Yeah, you're right.
The only culture is like watching people get murdered.
Yeah.
But even then, in the gladiatorial ring, there's no decoration. There's no big statues of previous Harkonnens. I mean, even in Star Wars, there'd occasionally be an old amphitheater that there would be ruins of somewhere or something like that that had old statues. But they didn't have that. The only touch they had in that, which I did enjoy a lot in that gladiator ring, was because everyone looks the same. All the Harkonnens look identical, apart from the weird
another common misconception. Misconception. Offense that's offensive about bald men. Thank you.
Exactly. Karen? They had these guards inside the ring that had these weird kind of crescent moon hats.
Yeah. They were scary as. They were really good, and they have these horrible little hooks they hook into your back. Yeah. Really hard, really grim. Yeah. You know what I reckon the rule is with clutter in films like this is. If you start having clutter, so I'm looking around the kitchen I'm in right now. Mm. I can see...
How many dead concubines can you see?
Well, the trouble is the council's run out of money, so they're only picking them up every 3 weeks or so these days, aren't they?
And a few of them had some crone earlier, so if they've got some lime lodged in their neck, I don't know which one to put. But, so I'm looking around my room right now. I've obviously got my vat of black slime... Yep. For after the recording, that's that's sitting there ready. Mm-hmm. The two types of slime have separated a bit in it, so I have to give it a mix up before I get in. No, but I'm seeing, right now, for example, I can see about 25 pens.
Yeah.
I can see a remote control sitting on top of a metal box. I can see a thing full of tomatoes. Mm-hmm. I can see a little pot of mustard. I can see a three bean salad mug available at the three bean salad shop.
Beautifully done.
Similarly, in front of me, I've got a mushrooms greetings card. Which
who's going to be lucky enough to receive that?
I've been planning to text my friend Lisa, but I haven't got round to.
It's just a normal room, isn't it? It's got a greetings card with over 25 types of mushroom displayed on the front,
and nothing else.
Nothing else. What's the greeting on the inside? Is there a pre-written greeting with that one on the inside?
No, it's a very much add your own greeting.
Happy Spore Day.
why is it mushroom theme? Can you tell us?
Because my friend Lisa likes mushrooms.
There we go.
So I reckon the rule with clutter in these films is if you have any clutter, you've got to do loads. So if there was just like one pen sitting on a side table in one of those Harkonnen control center rooms, then you'd be like, well, why isn't there a mug? Why isn't there a post-it?
Why isn't there a mushroom themed greetings card?
There's literally no mushroom themed station.
Literally no
at
one
all.
In that nerve center had a birthday recently. What's going
what
on?
What the hell?
But do you not think in any film
get rid of the clutter.
Dune Universe, like in just like an indie comedy or whatever, about a character who's like a total mess, they'll show like their room to show that their life's kind of off the rails, and it will be tidier than any room in my house. But in like Harkonnen world, right, when they're in the gladiatorial arena, and there's literally like a million people there, all going, hey, hey,
hey. Quite stylish.
If you think about like when that ends and they go home, what on earth happens?
What are the transport links? What's the catering situation?
What's their house
what's
like?
The deal with the bogs?
What's the house? Exactly. What are they watching on telly? Do they have telly? Is there any journalism? Is there any magazines? No. Is there a W.H. Smith equivalent? You're right. You only see the kind of,
they just feel super, they feel really inhuman, which I think is the point, isn't it?
Yeah. But
there's something very chilling about that, I think.
Yeah, whereas other sci-fi films, probably maybe not that many, but that's why like a film like Blade Runner I really love, because that's right deep in the sort of grimy, you know, you're in the guy's flat, you're in the bars, he's walking around the streets, it's full of clutter and stuff. And
Yeah. Adverts and things.
Yes, exactly. So they're in the desert. He learns the ways of the desert.
Yeah.
They're very economical with water. They wear these suits which recycle sweat. And have quite unflattering nose, sort of nose tubes.
Yeah.
I don't know how.
Or vomit.
Yes, that's right. Well, they're not very consistent with that, I noticed. That's a bit nitpicking. But in theory, they're not supposed to cry and stuff, are they?
Yeah.
I was a bit like, and also, you know, when Zendaya and they would have been really sort of grumpy git of me to have shouted it at the screen, but really, you shouldn't actually be French kissing at this point when they start snogging.
Why not?
Is it only me that dribble?
How much moisture is lost?
Surely there's an exchange, isn't it? It's not.
Surely all the dribbling that happens. Yeah. And the vomiting.
The overspill.
And the crying.
Yeah. And then, the way that they sort of show that he's finally learned the way of the frenulum people is that he rides a giant worm.
Yeah.
And masters it.
A really big one.
Yeah. You know what I thought during... I mean, that was well done, wasn't it?
By the production?
By him. I mean, to come under a worm like that.
Oh, yeah, live, he did a great.
I mean, and it's very dangerous for the actor. I mean, it's incredible. That, I mean, yeah.
It was the first time as well. He didn't do any simulations or anything.
Didn't seem to have done. No, it was well done. The effects were good for that. Do you think for that? I thought it was quite...
The effects did great for all of it.
The effects were great for all of it. There were some bits of it where it almost got too big. Like the there was a point where the I mean, I'm skipping ahead a bit in the story, but there's a point where there's basically like a huge war. And you see...
It's done quite quickly, that stuff.
It is done quite quickly.
They sort of mentioned they've got some really big missiles.
Yeah, it's a bit... Is it a bit easy the way it's wrapped up?
Well, yeah, because the guy just goes, you didn't know about this, but you actually have 100 atomic missiles. It's quite...
Just...
It feels like, I don't know if that's from the book or anything, but it feels like, at the time it felt like a bit like, oh shit, we really painted ourselves into a corner script-wise here.
It doesn't obey the rule of Chekhov's rule, which is if a character discovers 100 atomic missiles in Act 5...
Just before the denouement.
Before the denouement, and within walking distance, apparently. they should have been mentioned in Act 1, or we should have seen them hung above the fireplace in Act 1. Because there's literally, it's a bit of, you're right, it's a bit of a kind of, should we be frank, it's a bit of a sort of a story that if a 7-year-old was improvising a story and they had to wrap it up, that they might just say, oh yeah, and there was 100 atomic missiles in it. Oh, thanks a lot, Brian. What a fucking waste of time that was. That was absolutely.
And what happened? They fired them. Yeah, it was a mixture of they fired the atomic missiles and some giant worms at the baddies, and that fine. Yeah,
right.
Well, that would do, I suppose. Suppose if you've got both of those.
I suppose in theory that works, doesn't it? Yeah, write it down in a novel called June. Yeah, I bet that'll be successful one day.
And also, if nuclear weapons exist in this way, why didn't they just nuke the planet when they wanted to kill everyone?
That's a good... Well, that's... Yeah. There's a few things like that in it. Should we be nitpicking gits? Should that be a section?
Git picking.
There's a lot of git picking that can be done.
Which is always the case, right, with any fantasy world thing, particularly with movie adaptations, right? Because something's
something's got to go somewhere. And it could well be that each of our nitpicks, there'll be someone who knows the book intimately.
Yes, like, no, you're right.
Actually, this is covered in the...
No, I think because
You've read it, haven't you?
This is covered in the postscript of the third book. Not included in all the publications, but in between 1977 and 1984, it was there.
Oh. Cranthor, rescue me from such foolishness.
In the Arrakian Old Testament, which was written 80 years after the original novel was written to just cover exactly this sort of question, it states very clearly.
And yes, I have built a fully functioning suit that recycles all my piss, which I wear on a daily basis. Yes.
And I'm pretty sure me and Zendaya would get on famously, actually.
Yeah. And also, I know two people called Paul, and one of them I used to get on reasonably well with. So I'd probably be friends with Paul Atreides if I was in the book. Because the book, which I have actually read twice...
Oh my God, you're like proper Dune.
I've not managed it. I've got it in the house. I've tried it a few times.
It's such a good book.
Absolutely. Maybe I should try again.
The book is so good. I love the book. But it's got huge sections, which I frankly skimmed a bit.
Oh, I love the book. It's wonderful. I love it. Yeah, I skimmed most of it. In the same breath, Henry.
Oh, so if I skim stones across, Lake Victoria, that means I don't love Lake Victoria.
That's actually a UN heritage crime to skim stones across.
Is it? Oh, shit.
You disrupt the algae.
Also, that's some of the flimsiest rhetoric I've ever come across. You know,
it was heavily flimsy. It's got some big sections of post notes which are describing the economy of Arrakis and how it works. Wow. So I think probably he did. A lot of this stuff, you're right, Mike, will be covered. But still being...
Did they see, do you know what I mean? Because it felt like you could even done a line of dialogue, right? Oh, don't forget to hide those missiles, by the way, Gurney.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What do you mean? He should have said that.
I don't... It feels like something that could have been seeded.
It could have been, couldn't it? You know. Could have been seeded. Although, having said that, it's hard to seed it without it being a bit clanging, like, hang on, that's going to come up later, isn't it?
Maybe.
Yeah, so you've got everything we need for the trip. You got your suit that recycles your piss, and, well, there's nothing else, because we don't have any clutter. There isn't anything in our universe.
Don't bring a novel. It's a bloody long ride, but please don't bring a novel.
Don't bring a novel.
Especially don't bring Dune, because that would make it really weird if you were reading it really Dune in the movie.
Don't bring anything that isn't going to be slimming. Quite tight outfits. And
just pop those 100 nuclear missiles in there. Just hide those. They're not a big deal. It'd be hard to sort of seed that subtly. But no, the point I was going to make was that... Oh, yeah, gitpicking.
Yeah.
I've got my own gitpick. You could do yours first.
Okay.
One gitpick I've got is... There's a lot of sword fighting.
This is my gitpick.
Yeah, I thought it would be. This is a big one. There's a lot of sword fighting, which is quite cool because it's got this mythological Roman Empire vibe, but at the same time futuristic. But they've also got laser guns. So it's one or the other. You can't,
There's all these scenes where they run into battle holding a small knife.
Yeah.
That you'd use to chop veg.
It's basically,
But they're in a world where you can vaporize someone in a moment.
And you can fly in between in galaxies and stuff.
And often they will do the same thing. They'll do that in the same scene. Yeah. Someone will get shot by a laser and then...
And just go, why don't you all have that?
Yeah. Tell you what, let's not bother with the old rifles. Let's...
No. Let's just use a selection of stuff that you could get in the kitchen department of any Sainsbury's. Isn't it? That's what they're using.
Because there was that one bit, wasn't there, where the guy had a pyramid of profiteroles and was just throwing them.
That's right.
In the face but they were really dry. Yeah. So if you got hit by one, might knock your nose flute out of your nostrils or whatever it is.
Yeah, so that's because once you've got the... Why are you just using the laser guns? They use them occasionally, but not always. This is another... I don't know what you think about this, isn't it, Pick? But I think, isn't it a bit weird that the Fremen... They're a sort of nomadic desert people, they're presented as, that live in tents and stuff. Mm. And they don't have any access to sort of technology, but they do have these thumper things, which are very much sort of... have they got some guns and stuff? So how did you make them?
They have some lasers. Got the lasers that are big enough to shoot through the massive mining ships.
Yeah, that's... Mike, I'm all over that as an issue in the film.
And they've got mines that come, big magnet mines that, yeah. So they do have.
And those lasers, they created these brilliant, I love the designs of the Harkonnen like mining ships that, the quite gross looking, like insecty looking black things that kind of squat down that are really brilliantly designed. But the lasers just cut straight through it, and like it shouldn't feel that easy to cut it in half.
Also, you'd think that it's a good point, because you think there'd be people going, you know how we've built this laser that can like chop a ship in half, but we live in a cave fundamentally. I know. Could we not spend a bit more time on the kind of aircon and maybe get a door?
Yeah, or maybe like pay someone to write a book just so we could read just have something to do. Just like
maybe get someone to print up a few mushroom themed gift cards we can send to each other. Can we talk about, and this might be a bit of an obvious or over talked about point, the link between Star Wars and Dune is insane, right? Like,
when was Dune written?
Yeah, which is first?
Dune's written before Star Wars, I think.
He must have read it.
Yeah. I think he did. I'm sure he did.
It's the same. I mean, there's so many things. And there were moments in this, like when he revealed that his grandfather was the baddie.
I kind of didn't really get that bit. Was he related to them, was he? Yeah.
Yeah, so Charlotte Rampling had shagged the Stellan Skarsgård, basically.
No, not Charlotte Rampling. Rebecca Ferguson.
No.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Ferguson. You're right. It was Charlotte Rampling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She. What did Charlotte Rampling do?
Well, either way, Rebecca Ferguson was the Baron's
daughter.
And we only discovered that at the end, do we?
Near the end.
Towards the end, yeah.
Right, yeah.
But if we're taking off kind of Star Wars things, right, there's the baddie turns out to be the goodie's dad, essentially.
Yeah.
The huge one for me is the kind of like the ancient religion in space thing.
Yes. The Force.
Which is cool. Is cool. Yeah.
And it's cool. But yeah, but the Bene Gesserit, the witches, that's all very much like the Force, the fact they can use this voice to control you. It's in fact, the voice to control is basically the same, isn't it? Because Obi-Wan goes, these are not the droids you're looking for.
The use of swords, which has just been upgraded, quite beautifully done in Star Wars.
The use of swords.
The desert planet thing.
Oh, yeah. There's a desert planet.
And also what a themed planet thing as well, right? Because we don't get much of it in Dune, but there's a desert planet, but the we get the impression with the Atreides planet that they come from that it's like the northwest coast of Scotland.
Yes.
Everywhere. There's no tropical climate
That's
in
a
the
good
middle
point.
Or anything.
Everything is one.
Everywhere is the same, which is a very Star Wars-y. The whole planet is just.
That's so true. It's one thing.
It's rocky. It's rocky and islandy and sea-ish, or it's icy, or it's, you know.
Yeah, it's Scotland world.
But that's not even true of Scotland, is it?
It's not even true of Scotland.
No, exactly. And the Harkonnen world, I think, is just like a sort of junkyard world, basically. But
Mike, you know why that's one of the tropes of science fiction, though, is that all planets are the way they are all around, all over?
Yeah.
Because it's to justify the fact that no matter where your spaceship lands, it's in a representative area of the planet.
Nice.
Because if your planet lands somewhere and it's a desert planet, it's a really weird moment in a film where if Spock has to, you know, Kirk has to go, God, it's really hot and dry here. How are we going to survive? And Spock... You know, then Spock would have to go. No, it's actually quite a moist planet in parts.
Yeah, we're in the part known as Wiltshire.
We're in the Wiltshire,
incredibly fertile,
though
clay soil.
That's right, but the Gulf Stream means that the springs can be mild.
But of course, the El Nino effect means that this year particularly is a lot of rain, sir.
Yeah, and then 45 minutes later, you could finally start the episode. Yeah.
But also, then what outfit would they wear? Because they have to be wearing the same outfit the whole time. There's no luggage, Mike. You can't have variation in topography and climate without luggage.
True. As a kid, that was something I always loved about sci-fi. I liked that.
The lack of luggage?
The planets were uniform.
Yes.
Like one would be entirely high-rise buildings. One would be entirely ice.
The suburban planet, the suburban world. The entire planet.
Outer bypass. But it's quite hard to walk anywhere. You will need to drive places, but the gardens are roomy.
World.
Great parking world. You can park everywhere.
But if you're not into parking, you're going to hate it because it's just parking. You can park, but you can then park the car and then walk to another place that, where the car's parked. There's nothing to do.
Pretty decent, but yes, all the entertainment is very much centralized in one place where you go for, to shop and to go to the cinema and bowling. Leisure. It's all in the Nando's. Same area.
I suggest we use Parking World and actually then you park there and then use the park and ride shuttle service to go to Nando's World, which is a planet next door, and then we can use the fucking
high street on a Saturday night a little bit too late when people are queuing for kebab house world.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
Do you ever get picked, Mike? Some little annoying and pedantic inconsistency?
I mean, there have to be some things like that, right? They view the southern hemisphere as being impossible to get to because there is a belt of sandstorms in the middle.
Yeah.
Have you got spaceships? Why don't you just...
You've got spaceships, mate.
It's around,
isn't
it?
It's the dragon's paradox from which absolutely clusterfucks the entire Tolkien trilogy.
What's the dragon?
You've got a dragon, just go straight there, get the ring, come straight back. You'll be done before, tea time. Just get on the dragon and go there and get it and come back. Just get on the dragon and do it. Just get on the dragon and do it. Just get on the dragon and do it. Bosh, bosh. Every single plot device destroyed. Every character destroyed. The entire universe. Rubble. Just get on a dragon and do it. And I think the same goes for... the same sort of goes for the worms. Like, they're riding these huge worms. Just use them to win everything. You've got the huge mega worms and atomic bombs. Because this film does get the scale of it. Like, the scale of the battles... huge battles at the end and the scale of the worms and stuff, but partly I had a weird thought, which is some things I felt like are too big to show. Like, what's the point of, like, when you read a book, maybe this is just me, but
there can't be many people still listening as it is.
it's a very good point. So it's just me. When you read a book,
yeah,
you actually use... I've got... Basically, in a way, we've all got our own special effects department. Haven't we? What? It's called the human imagination. And
yeah, mine only does sound, though.
It does quite basic sound, isn't it? With quite a limited Foley selection.
It's just Foley. It's footsteps and cloth, actually.
Cloth?
Yeah.
Different types of cloth, or?
Yeah, like different sort of materials of trousers rubbing together when people are walking along. That's about as far as they go.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if it's someone, say, for example, creeping through a BHS.
Oh, no.
You could, you could do that quite well.
Creeping.
Oh, you couldn't do creeping?
Probably. I could.
Confident struts?
It's strutting, marching and strolling.
Yeah. the only three things that are sort of a nobleman needs to be able to do with his legs. Yeah, a self-respecting nobleman.
Yeah.
And Mike, you've also got hogs, brackets, misc as well, haven't you?
I do.
Yeah. Hogs in crisis, hogs in peril, hogs on the run.
I use quite a lot. I do have to use that as a sort of filler, sort of placeholder for quite a few things in my imagination.
So it's just a series of different cloth textures and walking paces. And an occasional, for a bit of drama, an occasional panicking hog.
Yeah, my dreamscape is absolutely horrifying. I fear sleep.
Yeah. Which is like Margaret Thatcher, you get 1 hour a night, don't you?
It's the most I dare to get, yeah.
So you were saying that it's not worth seeing.
No. What I was saying, these huge battles, I was like... And maybe even the riding the worm bit, I was like, okay, so when you read it, you picture this epicness based on, and his language is quite minimal in a way, but you picture these quite simple sentences, and then you have to picture it. You just picture these incredible epic things happening in your own brain. And I have...
Which for Mike sounds like this. That's an atomic weapon going off, isn't it, Mike?
Yeah. And that's also like...
It's a breeding sow.
Yeah. That's also a love scene between Napoleon and Josephine. pretty much exactly the same, isn't it?
Yeah.
But
poor sign. Sex scene, Armageddon, much of a muchness. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's why your favourite book is Jeffrey the Pig Gets Some New Trousers, isn't it? That's it.
My wife reads it to me every night.
I was watching, like, so what they've done is they've read the book. Now, say, I am lucky. I have an absolutely superb imagination. It's probably actually slightly better than the film, my imagination. It's just, I can't help it. It's just, I read it and I picture it really well.
Yeah.
And
every grain of sand.
Yeah.
And you've paid for the Chalamet upgrade, haven't you, to your imagination?
Yes,
where you can
exactly
put Chalamet into the.
I could put him into anything. I could put him into memories. remembering stuff. I am played by Chalamet in a lot of my memories. And so is everyone else in the memories. It's quite confusing to keep track of what's happening, to be honest. But what they've done is they've read the book. Partly I was thinking about the sheer amount of effort that's gone into it. So, like, they've read the book. They've gone, bloody hell, this is going to be fucking hard. Of course, show a guy driving a giant worm. I mean, that is hard to depict on screen, believably. And they've basically pulled it off. I mean, they've put a huge amount of work, huge amount of manpower, time, energy, money. They've done it. It's incredible. But at the same time, why? It's in the book. You just picture it. You just, in 1 second, I picture it brilliantly, perfectly. I mean, there isn't an Oscar for what I do.
But you can imagine yourself receiving an Oscar.
I can imagine myself winning it really realistically.
And probably even of them playing that clip of an earthworm with a Playmobil man standing on top of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever it was that was in your head at the time.
Exactly. Or as Mike would picture it. I can't. I'm not very good at doing hogs.
That was very goblin-y.
I'm absolutely rubbish at doing hogs. What a way to find out.
That's right. I recorded that. I might use it for something later.
But do you know what I mean? And with the battle,
I had the same thought when the names at the end were coming down. The credits are so long. Because it's just trillions of people on VFX. It was like VFX. And then it would just be like 2 minutes of names going past.
Yeah.
I was like, what a waste of human life.
Can I say, a lot of people... I agree with you. A lot of people walk out before the credits finish.
Not me.
Whereas people like me and you, Ben, I respect the process. So I'll sit there and check my phone till the end, till they stop.
Did you see the secret scene of the end then?
Yeah.
A little funny.
Little funny, the worm doing stand-up.
Yeah, yeah.
Lovely little touch.
Bit blue for my taste.
It was a bit blue, wasn't it?
Yeah. Fair play to him.
What were you saying, Ben? You have the same thought? Oh, yeah, just the manpower, the amount of people that
the
had to do
it. The sheer number of man hours was kind of, is it?
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah. But also, like, when you know that each person you see on that screen has spent 18 months animating a corner of a worm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For all that time.
That may not get used as well, exactly. Right? I mean, there'll be people there who would have done some worm work that didn't make it, right?
There'll be people who they've measured what they've been doing for the last 5 years are just a proportion of shaft. So it's like I've been doing like 2/19 of the lower mid shaft.
Yeah.
On one of the worms. Did you know what I mean? Just like a section of worm.
Yeah.
That's basically what you just said, Ben, isn't it?
Exactly what I just said. Yeah.
You said it like, yeah.
All for what is essentially really just a rom-com without any jokes.
Here's something. Did you really get a sense? I'm not sure if I got enough of a sense of how hot it was. That's a big.
It's really hot.
Do you feel that watching it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's a desert planet.
It's a desert planet, but I just feel like.
No one was going, ooh, I'm gasping.
Yeah, no one basically ever said that. All they needed was one line.
Yeah.
For someone to
bloody
say.
Hell.
Oh, I'd love a 7-Up.
Someone coming out of a cave after some weird magical ceremony, you know, you just want Javier to go, bloody hell. Oh, fearsome one today, isn't it, lads?
Or actually a bit of a sweat. I didn't think anyone sweats in it. I just didn't think, I didn't feel the heat. Like, I suppose they've got those suits that recycle it. But I think it's a big thing in the book is it's terrifyingly hot.
No, they don't look sweaty. There's not even much sheen, generally speaking.
There's no sheen. Very matte.
Yeah.
People are very matte. Okay, here's a big. This isn't even a gitpick. This is a genuine nitpick.
Mm.
Am I imagining this? Or I felt like there was a bit of the beginning, quite early on, where it's set up by an actor that has had all the external signs of being Javier Bardem.
Yeah.
Says to Paul Atreides, you've got to do the kind of like a kind of rites of passage thing where
yeah.
you have to cross the desert, spend yeah. the night, and then come back.
Yeah.
Don't watch out for the centipedes and the spirits and all this yeah. kind of stuff. And it just didn't happen.
Yeah. He climbed up a small dune and then Zendaya was already there.
Zendaya was there.
They had a bit of a chat and then moved on next day.
Yes, you're right.
Yes, yeah. we didn't was see any hardship. We didn't see him collapsing face first into the sand, desperate for water.
Yeah. But it felt like it'd been really specifically set up for all these things that were going to happen, like the centipedes.
His great trial.
Yeah. That was a mistake, I thought. Or maybe it was cut, or I don't know.
Yeah. Did they just go and have a snog instead?
I didn't really quite snog at that point. One bit which I felt bad for Zendaya is when he, at the end, absolute stab in the back, he just suddenly, right in front of her, says, I'm going to marry the Emperor's daughter, please.
Yeah.
That was horrible. He does a political marriage, doesn't he, at the end?
It's a real dick move.
But it shows that he's different from his father, who was weak and ruled with his heart, not his head.
Oh, that yeah.
But he's got the stones to do what needs to be done.
Well, he could say stones, but does he? Or does he just do what his mother told him to do? Do you know what I mean?
Good point, Mike.
So is that stones or is that the opposite of stones?
Or maybe he'd been looking for an opportunity to break up with Zendaya. You
know. Sometimes, yeah.
And sometimes you just have to get someone else you quite like who looks a bit different. You just have to challenge their dad to fight to the death or their champion.
Because he saw Zendaya as more of a friend, essentially. Still keen on her.
Yeah.
But that conversation is awkward, isn't it? So if you can
it
do a fight with
a holiday
death.
Romance at the end of the day.
Actually, they are from different cultures. You know, in his culture, they've got no books. In her culture, it's really hot and they've got no books. But it's a different culture, isn't it? At the end of the day, he's got more in common with the...
He's got empty stone rooms being washed by the sea. She's got empty stone rooms that get all the sand in you.
Yeah.
Your socks and stuff.
I've got a slightly broad comment to make here.
Okay.
Also, no one ever gets any sand trapped in their penis or arse.
Beautifully put as well, lovely.
In the films. Or no, in their pants. Oh, God, bloody... God, sand gets everywhere, doesn't it? No one says that.
Also, you know when the worms... You know when the worms eat something?
Yeah.
Does it upset you as much as it does me when they also ingest quite a lot of sand?
Yeah. That's a good point. And also, we never see their huge, colossal, magnificent dumps. Mate, you realize you just spent last night sleeping on a dump. Huh? You idiot. Huh? Do you know what I mean? There's none of that.
Yeah.
So, should we bring this to a close?
I've got a last broad comment to make.
Okay.
It's quite broad. Dating in the world of June.
Mm-hmm.
Who would you date? The choice is... Someone from the Harkonnen.
Yep.
Bald, all men, as far as I can tell.
Pretty, yeah. It's
there's the occasional subjugated female. Subjugated ultra, ultra evil, cannibalistic female.
Or cannibalistic harpy. Yeah. or Bene Gesserit.
Yeah.
They know the desert. I'm going to say slightly humorless.
Yeah. Lots of face tattoos.
A worm, actually. or one of the Bene Gesserit.
You said that twice, haven't you?
Have I?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I didn't.
Who would you date?
We've got Harkonnen and Bene Gesserit, worm Bene Gesserit are our options.
Yeah. or Fremen.
Or Fremen.
Yeah. Well, Fremen for me.
Would you go for a Fremen?
What, over a worm?
There's a Bene Gesserit in the mix, mate.
Yeah, but they're a sort of weird, evil, religious fundamentalist.
I love that. I would love to date a Bene Gesserit.
You want to be dominated?
I find them very exciting, the Bene Gesserit. I really like them.
You're going to have a pair of 20 deniers lashing you to a bedpost within seconds, my friend.
So to round off, are we doing... We'll do a sort of yay or nay, basically.
Is that a part of the format?
Yeah.
Blimey. Okay.
Henry, yay or nay?
Yay.
How big a yay?
Average.
Mike?
Nay.
What? Nay!
I was very impressed by it. Like, it's amazing what they've done, but it did also feel like bloody hard work half the time.
Blimey! You kept that on your quiet film corner. Yeah. Blimey. Okay, interesting. It's an A.
Yeah. Overall.
Well, all right.
Wow.
Ben has the casting vote. Mm-hmm.
For me, it's a big yay. Love it.
Okay.
Love the world. Anytime anyone's being eaten by or riding a worm, I'm happy.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yes.
Nice to see your spiritual brothers, the worm, on the big screen for once, isn't it?
June 2, everyone.
Yeah. Great.
June 2. You've been listening to Film Corner.